This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, what do animals think and feel? The Cincinnati Zoo's Thane Maynard has a conversation with Dr. Carl Safina about that. Joining us first to discuss human trafficking and the work that's being done locally to improve the situation, our program manager for anti-human trafficking at the Salvation Army of Greater Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, Aaron Meyer, Deputy Director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, Sasha Naiman, and human trafficking advocate with Kentucky Rescue and Restore, Lisa Ramstetter. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sasha, Lisa, and Aaron, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Aaron, what exactly is human trafficking? How's it defined, and what are the different forms of human trafficking?
Well, that's a great question. I think to a lot of people, it's unclear, and a lot of people thinking that it relates more to drug trafficking and the concept of bringing a person into the country, smuggling someone into the country. That can be part of human trafficking. But really, what it is it's any situation where someone is being, whether it's a man, a woman, a child, an individual who identifies as trans, who is being exploited either through work or labor services, commercial sex, which could take the form of child pornography and other elements, and that exploitation is occurring for someone else's financial gain. And in that process, there are elements of force, fraud, and coercion as part of the federal and local definition. But what that means is that that individual is being either threatened or lied to, or other elements otherwise coerced to remain in that situation and feels that they can't leave. So here in Cincinnati, we see different types of trafficking. All three of us here work with those different survivors in different capacities, and it is very real here in the greater Cincinnati and northern Kentucky area.
Is it only trafficking if it involves being transported across a national border?
No. And I know Sasha works most often, I believe, with the local victims of trafficking. But that's part of the misconception, that trafficking includes some sort of movement. And sometimes there's movement, but that movement might be across the street. It doesn't have to be any kind of border crossing or any kind of jurisdictional crossing. It's just, which is part of the misconception.
Yeah, most of my clients, they are domestic-born and trafficked by somebody who is domestic-born. There's certainly potential movement. Like Aaron said, it could be across the street. It could be down the street. It could be from downtown Cincinnati into the suburbs of Cincinnati. But the key is that they did not have the ability, ultimately, to say no. They were forced into
something. They're forced into this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How bad of a situation is it in this area?
It's hard to tell. There's some recent efforts at the national level to try to get a better prevalence understanding. The best data that we have in Ohio as it relates to prevalence is from 2009, which is really not recent at all by research standards. Dr. Celia Williamson and some other researchers throughout the state of Ohio have developed the Human Trafficking Institute out of the University of Toledo. And right now they're trying to better answer that question of what is the prevalence here, not only in Ohio, but on a national level, and there's some other research foundations that are working on that. What we can say for us is that we've served over 400 individuals, probably closer to over 500 individuals at this point, through the 5 years that our program has existed. We know that our other partner agencies, Off the Streets, has said that upwards of 40% of the clients that they serve annually are trafficking victims. And so there are various it's certainly a prevalence. It's an issue here. It's certainly prevalent. But exactly what the numbers are and how they compare to other communities is still just something we don't know at a state, local, or national level.
We know that because each of us serve different clients who have been trafficked, that it's definitely happening. But the challenges lie in actually having people report those crimes and seek services in becoming free from their slave-like situation. So Kentucky Rescue and Restore, through the Catholic Charities of Louisville and up here in Covington, have been doing research to collect data about What types of people have been trafficked who have come in contact with law enforcement and our program seeking additional services? And, you know, are they from another country? Were they brought here for the purpose of being trafficked? Are they being trafficked in their own home where they grew up? Are they being trafficked by an intimate partner or a family member or a friend? And so we're collecting data on that over the course of the last 10 years since our program started. We've served hundreds of victims or survivors of trafficking. So the more awareness people have out in the community about what trafficking looks like and can better recognize it and report and let people know who are being trafficked that there is support for them, the more that we're able to collect that information and better have a better number for that.
Lisa, who is most often a victim of human trafficking? Who can become a victim?
Well, the State Department thinks that foreign nationals are the highest population of people trafficked in this country, about 80% to 20%, and that Americans are being trafficked a lot in the communities as well. We have more statistics on Americans who have been trafficked, I think, because most of that trafficking of American victims is in the sex trafficking industry, and so we're coming in contact with that in law enforcement. And whether someone's being arrested initially as a criminal for being involved in the commercial sex industry, or if they are being, come to law enforcement for help, we're encountering a lot more of them. But foreign nationals are engaged in labor trafficking in this country. They're brought to this country legally on visas at times, these HB visas, to work and then trafficked when they're here. And due to threats that they're receiving from someone back home in the country from where they came who helped them get the job in the United States, or whether they're being trafficked by their manager on the farm who's not giving them their wages and threatening them if they try to leave or tell, then that will happen. And they may even come to the country and serve all of their time on their visa and out of fear go right back to their country without telling anyone that it happened. And so this can happen on visas. It can happen in restaurants, nail salons, or even in domestic servitude situations in homes when people come to work as a nanny or a housekeeper. And then the situation they start working in is just not what was told that it would be. They might not be paid. They might be abused. There might be violence used against them. All kinds of things that keep them from telling and seeking freedom.
How much does this affect women? More impact on women?
Women are by far more impacted than men. It doesn't mean that there are not victims who are male. There's victims who identify as trans. There's men, especially among children. Young boys are a group that's trafficked. But statistically, women are more likely to be trafficked. Children are also a risk group. And then anybody with some kind of vulnerability. So what the traffickers are looking for is somebody who might have an addiction or a mental health issue. They might be homeless. That puts somebody in a vulnerable category. And then a pimp might attract that person into the trafficking situation.
How do they do that? How do they recruit their victims?
So part of at the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, part of what we need to do is to help survivors tell their story to the courts when they're seeking expungement. And we're telling this part of how they're being lured in. And it's actually so subtle for so many of our clients that even they have trouble explaining where the luring process actually started and then where the trafficking started after that. Oftentimes, it's involved in offers of support. You're homeless. We'll give you a place to stay. You're addicted. We'll give you free drugs. You don't have a family that cares about you. We're going to provide you with a family. We're going to provide you with love. In fact, even the very terms family and love start to take on a completely different meaning in this environment. So for the victims, they're restructuring what they expect. They think this is love. This is family. For people who are very young, for children, sometimes the pimp will promise to make them rich, make them famous, buy them clothes that their family could never buy them, buy them technology, like I'll give you a cell phone, get your hair done. And so the victim will interpret this as somebody who's actually a positive person who will stand up for them, who will protect them. And then that evolves into you owe me money, involves into abuse, physical, verbal, it evolves into threats. Sometimes it evolves into truly torture of the person. And eventually they have no ability to say no because they've been put into such fear.
Mm-hmm. And going off of that, both for labor and sex trafficking situations, it's oftentimes someone that the person either knows or feels comfortable with. Going off of what Sasha was saying, that it's this relationship that's building, whether that's a friend of a friend or someone's older boyfriend's friend or someone you see hanging out at the library when you go there to study and hang out with your friends and they become a familiar face, or labor trafficking, a friend of a family member, or even in some cases, you know, a village elder or someone who has high standing in the society or the community of origin. And so it is really this slow build, and it isn't often this what we see on, you know, movies like Taken and other places where it seems like this kidnapping situation that does happen in other countries and it does happen in other communities. But typically what we're seeing when it relates to trafficking here is part of the reason they can't pinpoint when it started is it probably started way before they even thought that it was even a trafficking relationship. It just seemed like a friend or a family member who set them up or started using that, started being more influential in an exploitative and abusive manner. So it really builds slowly. And then it's networked within. So then now I know somebody and I'm being victimized, but maybe I'm being asked by my trafficker to find a friend in school or find a friend at the shelter or find a friend at the foster home. And then again, that recruitment begins again.
So some people might ask, why not just run away, try to escape from this?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, I say this all the time, but, you know, the mentality is very similar to domestic violence. It's the same type of idea. You know, so often we, when we're working with providers and they, you know, or people that just don't understand the issue, they might say, well, she had a phone. I don't know why she didn't leave. Or, you know, she came to an appointment at my office. So I don't know why she's still in this situation. But we don't say that of domestic violence victims. You know, we don't say, well, she goes to work and she doesn't leave at work, or she, you know, she goes to the grocery store and doesn't leave. It's a long cycle of abuse and exploitation. As Sasha was mentioning, this creation of this perception of dependency, and that's true again in labor trafficking. It looks a little bit different oftentimes, but we had a case once with a situation of domestic servitude where the trafficker wouldn't allow that person to leave the house at all. So they were dependent on that individual for food, for clothes, for a toothbrush, and they felt, they were told that the outside world was unsafe, that they would be arrested and deported if they were seen outside by any community member. And that dependency is created. And when you have that dependency created, it can be really hard to feel confident in yourself, that you can do things on your own and live independently. But then also there's that fear that something, you know, they've created this fear that something more terrible will happen, that, you know, like you'll get deported or you'll get abused or your family will get hurt or something of that nature. So it's an entrenched long-term belief structure that's created.
I think so, Erin. And I think one of the key words that you used there was promises, either the promise that, oh, I won't hurt you again, or, oh, I will pay you next time, or this is going to be different for you, or the promise that I will harm your family back home, or I will hurt your best friend, or I won't give you access to your children ever again if you don't do exactly what I do. These promises and threats against someone's life or the life that they want for themselves. So then they become complicit in the crime and subject to whatever their trafficker is telling them to do, so that they can somehow keep some sort of control over their life by just doing exactly as they're told to do, exactly when they're told to do it. And I think in labor trafficking too, that slow sort of move from maybe working at a restaurant to being trafficked at that restaurant could look like some initial discrepancies in what was told to you that you would be doing, to slowly your wages being cut down and you being told, well, you'll get that money later and we'll pay all of that to you, but right now it's just a tough week here at the restaurant and we can't pay that to you, so we'll pay it to you later. And so from threats from someone that you continue working there in combination with these wages being kept from you, there's this hope and this promise that you'll get those wages. And as those wages build up to hundreds
so
and thousands of dollars,
along is what they do.
They'll string you along. And when you need that money for maybe your family back home or to pay your landlord who you've been promising, I'll pay you, my boss is going to pay me, and it will work out. And for an immigrant who might not know that exactly what trafficking is or that there's help for them, and if they're undocumented in fear that that they won't be treated fairly in the court system, in the justice system, then they are at least less likely to say something. But the reality is that they're victims of these federal crimes and they have rights in this country. It doesn't matter where you're from, if you're in the United States, you're protected by federal and local laws. And so this is something that we are working as an agency through Rescue and Restore to communicate to our communities and immigrant populations in particular through outreach and trainings that you have rights and that even though labor trafficking is happening in these immigrant communities, people aren't saying anything for fear of not knowing what their rights are if they think that they've broken the law in some way by outstaying their visa or something, and now they're stuck in these trafficking situations and just don't feel like they have protection. So this education that we're doing is ongoing, and I know that at Enslavery Cincinnati they do a lot of education too, but through Catholic Charities it's one of our main focuses other than victim services.
We will continue our conversation about human trafficking and local efforts to counter it. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, here to discuss human trafficking and the work that's being done locally to improve the situation. Our program manager for anti-human trafficking at the Salvation Army of Greater Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, Aaron Meyer, Deputy Director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, Sasha Naiman, and Human Trafficking Advocate with Kentucky Rescue and Restore, Lisa Ramstetter. And you can join us with your questions and comments at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Sasha, how common is it for human trafficking to be going on around us in plain sight, but oftentimes we don't know it or we don't even recognize it?
It's very common for it to be going on around us, and it's absolutely correct. We don't know that it is human trafficking. We don't recognize it. The clients that come to Ohio Justice and Policy Center, they are survivors of trafficking who are they've found their freedom and they have criminal records that are creating obstacles to finding employment and to reintegrating into society. And the reason why they have these troubles is because, first, they themselves don't realize it was trafficking. So you're saying we don't realize it. Sometimes the victim doesn't realize it was trafficking. But also, as they go out into the community, they're trying to explain these records. People don't understand that what happened in this situation was, in fact, trafficking. These records didn't stem from somebody making a choice to do something illegal. They were compelled into it. And I think that both Lisa and Aaron had mentioned how ultimately people become a part of these illegal activities, and it's viewed sometimes as drug activity or prostitution, but it's not viewed as human trafficking. And it's very important for both the victims and for our court systems and for people out in the community to understand that what's happening, that is human trafficking. Where there is prostitution and the victim doesn't have an opportunity to say no, that's human trafficking. If there's labor, if there's commercial sex that's happening under force or under fear, that's human trafficking.
And I think it's also part of what makes it so complicated is there's so many different venues for human trafficking to be taking place. So we may see it on the streets in the form of street prostitution or pimp control prostitution on the street. That's probably one of the easier places to see it, where it looks like it could be exploitative, sometimes in restaurants, but oftentimes it's it might be in people's homes in domestic servitude where you never see somebody, or brothels in traffic. There's definitely brothels throughout the city of Cincinnati, or in massage parlors or other locations where it's not necessarily you don't see the exploitation right away. And when we haven't talked a lot about demand, but when we talk about demand, whether it's labor or sex trafficking, traffickers know that, generally speaking, if people knew that someone was being exploited, they'd want to help. So generally speaking, even when they're looking to engage a John to buy commercial sex, they're not standing right next to the woman on the street, and they're not sometimes they are, but more often than not, they're not standing right next to the woman on the street. She's on her own. They're maybe watching from a window across the street, or maybe there's another woman who's been there in the trafficking network longer and who's monitoring the situation, kind of reporting back to the main trafficker. And the same is true in restaurants. They're not verbally abusing employees oftentimes in the restaurant. You know, that's something that's happening in the back, or something that's happening in the form of wage theft or other elements. And so really these traffickers are working hard to make it seem like this is just a normal thing, which makes it then even harder for us as the community to recognize that this is actually an exploitative situation. And it requires outreach. It requires that education so that customers, participants, service providers recognize those small red flags or small outcries for help so that they can engage individuals and get them the services that they need, get them the law enforcement support or
what
whatever.
What might some of the small outcries for help be? What might you pick up on?
It really looks different for different people. I would say that, sometimes it might not even be a cry for help. So, for example, at the hospital oftentimes or other service providers, the victim might come to the location with the pimp or with the trafficker because the trafficker won't allow them to engage with somebody without them there. And so they won't allow the victim to be in the room with the nurse by themselves or to be in the therapist's office by themselves or the courtroom by themselves. And so in those situations where, as a provider, you might recognize, this is at a minimum a controlling situation, that this individual isn't allowing this person to be alone. Or oftentimes with foreign nationals, it's somebody who claims to be an interpreter and so says, I need to be in the room because I need to interpret for this person. When in reality, they are not. They are, controlling and maybe not even accurately translating the conversation. So that might be one, but there's a long list of the varying indicators, and it all depends on kind of where you might be engaging with somebody. So as a church member, it might look different than at somebody who is reaching out at church or to their pastor. We've seen that happen before where that's, it's an international symbol of kind of sanctuary. And so sometimes trafficking victims go there for help to a religious institution, or it could be on the street, or it just really depends on kind of what your role is and how you might engage.
And oftentimes the victims are coached what to say to police, coached what to say if they do go to the hospital, or they're simply not allowed to go out to the hospital. They're not allowed to go to the store. So the traffickers find ways to control how much there can be a cry for help by controlling what's said and by controlling where the victim can go. But as Aaron pointed out, there's still indicators that even without the victim coming forward and saying there's a trafficking situation, and they almost never come forward and say there's a trafficking situation, but the indicators might be where do you live and how do you sleep? If you're living in a one-room apartment with six women and you all share a mattress, that's going to be an indicator. Do you get to keep your money? The kind of hallmark of trafficking in many cases, not in all cases, but in many cases, is they have no control over their own financial resources whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So asking those kinds of questions as a nurse in a hospital or as a pastor or somebody who's coming into a situation as a community member who's concerned that there might be trafficking, there's red flags that they can look for.
Absolutely. And with labor trafficking in particular, you can look for some of those signs, and always you can look for signs of abuse and try to delve deeper into what's going on with that. Maybe some peculiar tattoos that the person might be trying to hide might indicate that someone forced them to get that tattoo as a means of branding them. And then also if someone's like visibly fearful and showing fear of what is going to happen if they don't quickly leave this meeting or quickly leave this doctor's appointment, or if they tell you something and they're like, I'm afraid that I told you that, I shouldn't have said anything, then who are they afraid of? And that's what we need to look deeper into.
And I would just add that both the local hotline and the national hotline are excellent resources for calling if you're not sure. So yes. They're both confidential. They're both not law enforcement. They're both non-governmental. So if you are not sure and you think it might be trafficking, you can always call those numbers 24 hours a day and just tell them the nature of the situation, and they can kind of help walk you through either next steps or kind of what might be some indicators should you engage with that individual again.
Let's talk with Anthony in Kenwood. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Hey, I would like to know if your panelists, your guests there, have any information or if they're familiar with the work of Ted Gunderson, former FBI chief Ted Gunderson in this area.
We're working with the local working group. So our agency, the Salvation Army Anti-Human Trafficking Program, liaises with the active working group, who are all, I believe, active law enforcement. So it's possible they're working with him as well. I'm not sure.
So Mr. Gunderson, he's actually passed. He met with an untimely death. But the reason I ask is because Mr. Gunderson's work, which happened purely by accident, centered around the male prostitution that's happened with boys. I mean, so far the implication based on your conversation has been around female sex trafficking. But Mr. Gunderson, he actually stumbled upon this really highly invasive sex trafficking of young boys from groups like the Boy Scouts, an organization called Boys Town, and primarily you find young males. And it reached the highest levels of our government, specifically with a man who was in Congress by the name of Larry King. This was back in the 70s and 80s. And this is little talked about, but it's just as pervasive as sex trafficking with young girls.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to know if anybody is doing any work in that area.
Well, our programs, I know mine does, and I believe Lisa's does as well. We work with men, women, and children, and the individuals who identify either as gender fluid or trans. And so we work with all victims of trafficking. And so you're right. It does happen here.
More commonly, though, it happens to women. But it does happen to men as well.
Definitely more commonly it's reported
from
women, but less. But
there may be some social reasons, too, why more women are reporting the crime than otherwise. But definitely statistically in Kentucky, what we've found out is that about 60% of the victims of human trafficking in Kentucky have been children, and a majority of those victims have been boys. So really, human trafficking statistics are looking different when you're talking about different age ranges and genders or nationality. But we definitely see that. And then I would say I'm seeing more labor trafficking victims who are men than women, too. So it's definitely going to vary from group to group.
Aaron, how do you think we're doing in making progress against stopping human trafficking? You think we're putting a dent in this? Or anybody can weigh in on this.
I think that's a great question. I think I know just from when I came to this community from D.C. and just about 5 years ago, I've noticed that there's a great interest in understanding the issue. There's a lot more providers than when I initially started working here that are aware of what the issue is and who want to be serving this population, want to be educated on serving this population. There's a lot greater awareness around the community. And I think there's a lot more because of that. That means there's a lot more specialized services for identified survivors in the community. And so I would say it's hard to tell how the prevalence, again, as we said, how the prevalence has shifted. But in terms of increased victim identification, which is kind of the most difficult, I think, of the elements, is that's definitely increased over the past 5 years.
We have about a minute left in the conversation, so a little bit about End Slavery Cincinnati. Has a conference coming up next month?
Yes. I think there's a couple different events among our different communities, but or different agencies. But yes, the Salvation Army's Anti-Human Trafficking, or End Slavery Cincinnati's Anti-Human Trafficking Conference, is going to be Friday, February 3rd at the American Red Cross. Registration is on endslaverycincinnati.org. Our hotline number is on there, too, if you need that.
Lisa, do you have anything coming up?
Well, Human Trafficking Awareness Day is this Wednesday, January 11th, and in Frankfort, Kentucky, we're having a big event. Starts at 10 a.m. And then if you have any questions about getting involved in Northern Kentucky, you can contact me at the Covington Catholic Charities. I'd love to hear from you.
And Sasha, anything from your
Sorry. We
provide ongoing services for survivors
24/7
for
expungement.
Well, almost. Yes, but we're a law firm that provides services ongoing. So our doors are open to anybody who's seeking an expungement because their records are related to trafficking.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Program Manager for Anti-Human Trafficking at the Salvation Army of Greater Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, Aaron Meyer. Deputy Director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, Sasha Naiman. And human trafficking advocate with Kentucky Rescue and Restore, Lisa Ramstetter. Coming up, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.